the full expression for the area operator in entirety is in Lavelli's book in section 6.6, if anybody's interested. And then we could go on to the volume. And what I'm going to do is just, now that you've seen the area, I'm just going to sketch the strategy for the volume. And then I'm going to sketch the strategy for the Hamiltonian constraint, which depends on the volume. So the strategy for the volume works the same way. Take a region R that you want to calculate the volume of. The volume of a region R is the integral of the determinant of the metric square root, and that turns out to be, and we'll count it. So let me take the determinant of the object E, and let's think about what that is. E is the square root of Q times the frame field upstairs, and we're taking the determinant of that. The square root of Q comes out inside the, so inside the, what is the determinant? The determinant is 1 over 3 factorial, epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK, E twiddle AI, E twiddle EJ, E twiddle CK. And so there are three powers, and the square root of the determinant of Q is also the absolute value of the determinant of E, the frame field just downstairs, because QAB is EAI, EBI, where E, just writing little e like that, is the basis elements for one forms, and it's dual to EAI, which are basis elements for vector fields, which is what these objects are. So this is 1 over 3 factorial determinant of E cubed times determinant of E upstairs inverse. The determinant of E upstairs is the inverse of determinant of E downstairs. So that's 1 over 3 factorial, actually 1 over, sorry, goes away in the determinant. That's E cubed, so that's E squared, where this is the determinant of E. So that's the same thing as the determinant of Q, AB. Therefore, the volume of the region R is the integral of the square root of the determinant of E. And that's what I wanted to get to by counting the determinant ways. And to say it in all its ugliness, it's the integral of the square root of epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK, EAI, EBJ, ECK is the vector densities 1 over 3 factorial. Now, that's almost right. It's wrong in one respect, which is that the Q is related to the absolute value of the determinant of E. The volume element is positive. But the E can have, the E being a frame field can have two orientations. It can have a left-handed orientation or a right-handed orientation. And the determinant of the right of E with right-handed orientation, but the same lengths of everybody, is minus the determinant of E with left-handed orientation. But the volume is a positive quantity. It doesn't care about the orientation. So there is an absolute value that goes there and there. Okay. So now the goal is going to be to find the eraser, after which we're going to do the same thing we did for the Maya, for the area. So the idea, roughly speaking, is similar to the area. I have a product of operators at a point. In this case, there's three rather than two. And then I want to take the square root, and then I want to integrate. And the idea is going to be the same. The idea is going to be to divide our big region R, and I can't draw it three-dimensionally, so you just have to believe this is three-dimensionally, into a bunch of a partition of little regions Ri, and to invent a guy called Wi associated to a region where Wi is related to the determinant of E on the region, which is to say, when the region gets very, very small, W becomes closer and closer, in the same sense that the A squared become closer and closer to the areas. And then we're going to define the volume operator, the region, as the sum over the different little volumes, the square root of Wi times, again, the limit as we take the number of regions to infinity. So it's a similar kind of regularization that than we did in the case of the volume, of the area. And the idea is that we do here, again, what we can. So I have my little volume. Let me see. Since I am ostensibly following Carlo, let me put the output on the side where Carlo puts it, which is there. So we're talking about the volume. Okay, and it has a similar story. So now on the little region, we want to define the cube of E. And so I start off the same way. I'm going to integrate three times over the region. So W in the region is going to have an integral d3. I can call it anything because I'm d3x, let's say. An integral of d3x prime, an integral d3x double prime. And then I'm going to take e at x, d at x prime, e at x double prime. They have some indices a, b, c. I'm going to put those into an epsilon a, b, c. And I'm going to be naive at first. And then I have to, as before, invent some curves that go between pairs of points. And then I go the u on the curve that goes between x and x prime, the u on the curve that goes from x prime to x double prime, the u on the curve that goes from x double prime back to x. And I trace the whole thing and get somebody gauge invariant. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that one does. The object, as I've written it, is not diffeomorphism invariant because I have this epsilon actually tying up indices at different points. And you can do something about that or not do something about that. I'm not going to do something about that. Because in the same sense that the area operator turned out to be all about just things happening at single points, when the two E's coincided, we're only going to get non-zero terms when all these three E's coincide. So this is the kind of thing we're going to do. And let me just tell you the idea. The details are more ugly than before, but let me tell you the key idea. There are actually two ideas, and both of them work, and they give slightly different results on certain complicated cases. So with this idea, here's the point. The point is that each E on a curve picks up the tangent vector of the curve. And that's the basic structure of the operator. So what happens if you have EA, EB at the same point, and you act on a curve? I'm just using just drawing a curve rather than a Wilson loop T of gamma. Well, look what you're going to get. And what you get more precisely is you get this object, which is integral ds gamma dot a of s delta 3 x gamma s. So that's what you get, but I'm just concentrating on the fact you get something proportional to gamma dot. So here, you get something that goes like gamma dot a, gamma dot b times the curve at some point. Okay. Times some singular factors. But that's what's happening to the tangent vectors. That's what's happening to the index a and b. Therefore, if you anti-symmetrize, you would get zero, because the anti-symmetrization of the product of two vectors is zero. Now, there's a little side story about that, of course. You don't really get zero, because what you should really do is act at two points and take the limit when you bring them together. And that gives you really, so you really have the two points, and so what you really have is gamma dot a times gamma dot b plus gamma double dot b plus gamma triple dot b, etc. You really should expand the gamma dot at a point here in terms of derivatives at this point and then bring them together. Right. And so what you really do is you pick up a term in gamma double dot, however, times something that's going to zero as you bring the two terms together. And what? Well, you don't get anything. You get I don't even know any way to make sense of that and really get an observable for the metric. But this is the kind of mess that you get when you look past leading order and some regularization. So, but notice something. Supposing you had a kink, and you took EA, EB, and you anti-symmetrized, okay? Well, then it's okay. Then you're going to get gamma dot A, gamma dot B, anti-symmetrized. But at a kink, if you regularize, one of them will pick up something above the kink and one of them below the kink. And so if you call this gamma dot plus and gamma dot minus, you'll get something like gamma dot plus gamma dot minus from a kink. So you'll get a leading order term from a kink. Now, what about if there's three of them? E, C, A, B, and you anti-symmetrize. Well, then you have the same, then at a kink, you lose again the leading order term. Because there's only gamma plus and gamma minus, there's only two of them. But imagine that when you had three of them, there was an intersection. Say you had curves alpha, beta, and gamma. And say you try to do this in a region of an intersection. Well, at any point off the curves, you get zero. At any point on one of the curves, you get zero because you get the tangent vector three times anti-symmetrized. But there is going to be some singular thing which just picks up the intersection times alpha dot A, beta dot B, gamma dot C, anti-symmetrized. So from three E's anti-symmetrized, you only have a hope of picking up a term at an intersection. And that's what happens from W. So W is a well-defined object, but there's an epsilon here which anti-symmetrizes these. So the result is that W in some region I only gives, on some loop states, only gives a non-zero term if there's some intersection in the region. So this acting on some spin network state, T of gamma, gives you something which is a sum over nodes of the spin network times terms where you pick up stuff happening at the nodes.
More than three.
Then you're going to get a sum over triples.
So you're just putting triples.
Yes, and you have to sum over all three. Okay. Now, each time, what you're getting, so let's think, let me think in the case where there's just three. When it's just three, so you're going to act at three points, and in the limit where the region becomes smaller and smaller, you're only going to pick up terms where there is an intersection, but while the region is still finite, you're integrating over the region three times. So you're only interested in the terms that are going to survive the ultimate partition, which is where there's a point picked out on each of the three edges. And then they're tied together by a triangle like that. So you're going to get a little graph like that. And we have to study, I haven't shown you yet how to do it, but we have to study the combinatorics of how you insert that little triangle into the graph. And then you're going to get some, if it works, you're going to get some combinatorial factor f times the graph back again with the intersection. And if you had spins j, k, and l here, you might hope to get an eigenstate j, k, and l with some combinatorial factor here that depends on j, k, and l when everything was said and done. What I meant by the combinatorial factor is you imagine as in the limit that you shrink the region down, you shrink a little, you have a little tetrahedron here, and the little tetrahedron gets shrunk down. And eventually just becomes a bunch of traces from which you pull out the original graph. So that's the nature of it. Now there's a fair amount of technology to pull those terms out. And I don't want to do that right now. I can give you the key thing. I think I should do that. And the key thing is that if I have an E inside of an edge, which has, say, spin J running on the edge there, and I intersect with some other guy with a spin K. So now I have an E sitting, this is like a trace in the J-th representation of E and a U in the J-th representation, and that's acting on a U in the K-th representation. What does that actually do? And what it actually does is you get the H bar G, you get the K, K plus 1, and you get a graph that looks like this. And what I'm going to do is blow up a little region. So this is just to tell you what's happening with the combinatorics. Maybe I'll write it in a better way. You get a node. Where the spin J is there, the spin J is there, the spin K is there, and the spin K is there. But I told you before the break that there could be different things inserted inside the node, a different invariant inside the node. And so if we blow it up and we look at what's actually going on inside that node, what's going on, let me write it like this. There's the spin J, the spin K, so I'm just moving the lines around. And then what happens here is that there's a spin 1 connecting two trivalent nodes. What there could be generally is a sum here. So what there could be generally, here's what I'm saying. I'm saying inside a node where you go J, J, K, K, J, K, there, the structure of the traces of the tensors looks like there's some guy of spin M times some M going across. So this is a particular diagram. We imagine what's happening here is shrunk down to zero, so this is just the identity in that representation. And this is the invariant between the spin J, J, and M representation, the K, K, and M representation. And the point is that all you get from the action of the E is the one representation here, times a factor which turns out to just be K, K plus 1. So then the little graph that you have here is, if I blow up what's going on in that tetrahedron, you have a graph that looks like this, spin J, J, K, K, L, L, and these are spin 1s running around the edges. And there's some combinatorial factor here, which is a function of J, K, and L, which you have to compute and extract. Okay. So that's the structure of it. Okay. Other questions?
Is it not that the spin network functions are eigenstates of this volume operation?
Here's what's known. Okay. What's known is the following. First of all, what's known is that for trivalent vertices, all of these are zero, which was a mistake that we made. So if you look at the paper where these things are actually first computed, we didn't know that because we made a sign error. Everything else in that paper is right, but we were so proud of the answer we made at the first equation. So for trivalent nodes, in other words, when you're done, let me see where I want to, I can put this there. when you're done, W for any region on trivalent nodes is zero. So they're eigenstates. They're zero bottom eigenstates. On four-valent nodes, so let's consider a general four-valent node. So I, J, K, L. What I just told you is that you can see that if you imagine just looking at the combinatorics of how the representations are multiplying, you can split a higher valent node into three valent nodes where you sum over. So we have I, J, K, L, and there's some representation N going across here. And for a general state here is a superposition of these for different states N. But let me just do it basis element by basis element. So let's start with the state, which is somebody in the representation N running across. For the same reasons as before, you don't get any infinite factors because you're integrating three times and taking three functional derivatives. So you don't get any infinite factors. You get something which is goes like h bar g cubed. And then you get some combinatorial factor which depends on n and replaces the n with another basis element. So you get something that could be called WNM acting on the state I, J, K, L, N. So you get, in other words, in the space spanned by the possible representations that could be here, you get a matrix, little W, N, M. And that little matrix, you get one such little matrix for every I, J, K, and L. There's a matrix in the representations that could be here. And then you can calculate that matrix. It's related to a bunch of 6J symbols. And I assume you do not have the formula handy. And the important thing is that, again, it can be shown to be Hermitian and positive semi-definite. There are cases of zero eigenvalue. And therefore, you can define the square root of this matrix, because you can diagonalize it since it's Hermitian, and you can take the square root of every eigenvalue. So that's the way you calculate the, and then you plug back into this formula. And the same thing happens. You make smaller and smaller partitions. And the only region that matters is the region around each node. And because nodes are distinct, you can make a partition fine enough in which there's only one node in every partition. So then you can perform the square root, you can perform the sum, and you can perform the limit.
So is it in principle possible to diagonalize this operator on one node for every tri node?
I'm trying to sort out what is precisely known and what is not known. What's certainly true is that up to some finite number, which I think is 6, 4, 5, 6, maybe you know better, the matrices are explicitly known. And I think for the general case, it's been shown that they are Hermitian and semi-positive definite. And I think they're explicitly known up to some case, which I don't remember if it's 6 or 8 or something. Occasionally, some heroic person grinds through some more. there have been people looking at very high valent nodes like Johannes, and there are some, I think it is a result that, which is an interesting result, that there is a smallest, no matter how high you go in valence, there's a smallest non-zero eigenvalue. I think that that's been shown. Okay, which means that there's a smallest quantum of volume. There's a lot of things which are known, but not known by me, about this operator. But certainly what's known is that the operator exists. All the limits on the board can be performed and have been shown for a general state. And the result is that the operator, so this is the important thing to say, that the operator acting on any spin network state is a sum of, on the nodes contained in the region, this is V of a region R, of the nodes of the graph in the region R. And on each node, there is a finite dimensional matrix, which is the square root of some W matrix, which acts on the state at each node in the way that I described, acts on the labels of the spin networks. So that's what's known. And the various things that I said. And that there is the same bare h bar g, when you take the square root, you get to the 3/2. Okay. Let me go on to the last operator I wanted to discuss, which is the Hamiltonian constraint. And I will be even sketchier. But I'll say enough to make it plausible that the operator can be constructed. So let me remind you what the Hamiltonian constraint is. So the Hamiltonian constraint looks like E twiddle A, I E twiddle B, J, F A B, K, epsilon I J, K. And then there's the cosmological constant term. But the cosmological constant is the term is the volume. Cosmological constant term multiplies the volume, which we just discussed, so we don't care about the volume term. That term we know how to deal with. Now, this is a density of weight 2 because of the 2 e's. So it's a density of weight 2. So it's problematic because you can't integrate it against the function. Now, there actually are results, and there are things which are known about that form of the operator. But almost all the work on the operator uses a different form, and that's the following. If I remember somewhere, I have the decomposition in terms of frame fields, the EAEB anti-symmetrized. So what is this? Let me just look at this object here. This object here is the determinant of E squared times EAI EBJ, EBJ anti-symmetrized in A and B and I and J. And this anti-symmetrization means that you can write this as epsilon ABC E lower CK epsilon IJK. So in other words, the anti-symmetric product of two frame fields for vectors, you can write as a frame field for one form. And now you have to match the density weights. And so this is a density of weight two here, here's a density weight one, so we need another density weight of one here. And I think I've done that right. Okay. That means the following. Supposing I wanted to make a density weight one object here, which would be I divide by, remember, determinant of E is E lower, which is like the determinant of the square root of Q that's up at the top, which is density weight one. So this is now a density weight one object. So then I divide by density weight, I just get that. And therefore, the density weight one object has a very Q form, epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK, EAK. Oh, but look, it's cool, there's another epsilon, so I didn't have to write it. Two epsilons, you should check that, multiply each other and go away. And you just get E lower A I F B C I, just like that. And that's cool because here again, there's only one object. So it's an even simpler object. Now, here comes the cool part. That sounds good, but what's an operator for E lower A for a frame field for one form? We only have an operator for the densitized vector frame field, not for the one-form frame field. And if I just go back to here, I just get to here. And at this point, Thomas Thiemann noticed something. And what he noticed is that EA lower I at a point x can be understood to be the Poisson bracket of the A, which is, has the same indices, lower one-form indices and GI and SU2 index, with the volume operator of the spatial manifold. And roughly speaking, why that works is if you go to the definition there of the volume operator, it's the integral of the square root of 3e's. The Poisson bracket, so you get 1 over the square root. Then the Poisson bracket of A with the 3e's gives you the 2e's. And the 2e's with the epsilons, because of this, gives you the e lower. And it really works. You should check it. Now, that's pretty cool, but we also don't have an operator for the A. But imagine the following. I start at some point x, and I parallel transport along a little curve. I'll call the curve gamma x hat epsilon a hat. So gamma x, so this is a little curve that starts at a point x, goes in the a hat direction, a distance epsilon. And here I have to call upon my, remember when I secretly had to call upon a sort of secret flat background metric to construct things in the previous one. So I'm going to call upon a little secret background metric. And it's going to turn out, and this is what you have to prove, that the quantities at the limit shown don't depend on this secret background metric. So it's just part of the regularization. It's arbitrary. But I do that. I just have a little secret metric, GAB background, that I use to tell me how long this curve is. And then I can consider U along that little curve, the parallel transport, and that's approximately 1 plus A in the A hat direction times epsilon at the point x, because that's the path-ordered integral along that little curve, but if that little curve is really, really little, is just 1 plus a times the length of the curve, okay, in the direction of the curve is going. So this is the same thing as parallel transport from the point x along the little curve x a epsilon, and parallel transport back. I'm doing it sort of in the wrong order. So there's a minus sign there that it's not in, but that's not going to. So parallel transport back along the little curve, and now take the Poisson bracket of the u with the v in the manifold. So I have a little parallel transport. Okay, I take the Poisson bracket with the u along the parallel transport with the v, and then I parallel transport afterwards to make something which is just gauge dependent at that point, and I can put that into some big graph and make something which is gauge invariant. So this is just a little piece of something in using that. So what I'm instructed to do now to get the e lower is pick a little curve segment, parallel transport backwards along it, take the Poisson bracket of that with the volume of space, then parallel transport back, and divide by minus 1 over epsilon, and take the limit as epsilon goes to 0. And that's the e lower. Okay. So remarkably, here we have a classical expression for e as a limit of objects, every one of which we know all about how to make operators for. Because we have the volume operator, we just constructed it. And we have operators that add parallel transports. They just add these little segments of loops. So we can take this, quantum mechanically, we can take this commutator. Yeah.
What if I put 4 products of u, gamma inverse in there?
It changes the overall factor.
Right, but it wouldn't change the limit.
It doesn't change. If you put the right factor here, it doesn't change the limit. So, and I'm not done yet, but so Thomas proposed that the operator for the single wave Hamiltonian constraint should be constructed of the following form. So first of all, I'm going to integrate this against the lapse. So the integral v3x against some lapse, which is a function, n of x, times epsilon abc times some u times the commutator of, I'm just going to call this u inverse because I'm being schematic, the volume operator of space, times an operator for the f, bc. And the whole thing is traced. And so the point is that this point where the little operator came out of, I put the f there. And I trace the f against the u's, and now it's gauge invariant. And now I'm getting somewhere. But I'm not done. Now I have there's a 1 over epsilon. So this is the regulated operator with epsilon. And sorry, epsilon and sigma look almost the same because I'm a jerk, but these u's depend on epsilon and the volume element depends on the volume operator depends on sigma. Okay, I'm not done yet. But the reason I'm not done yet is that the curvature f is not an operator either. The operator f, there is no such thing. There's no such thing as an operator a. And so there's no such thing as an operator F either, but we discussed that a long time ago. And what we discussed is that if you want to know the operator FAB at a point X, some point in the plane, and there's the A hat direction and B hat direction, what you've got to do is make a loop that goes around in the A hat and the B hat direction. So let's call that loop gamma A hat B hat. It has some area I'm going to call alpha. And then we take the parallel transport along that loop gamma AB alpha is based at the point X here. We subtract 1. We divide by 1 over alpha is the area. So actually, let me say that alpha is the length. And then we divide by 1 over alpha squared, which is the area. And that object we define to be the operator for the FAB at the point X. And it's regulated by a distance, which is alpha. So that's what I have to do over here. And when I'm done, look at the picture, because notice that there's this epsilon here. So the direction of the plane here is different from the direction that I'm making the measurement of the U in. So in the end, I have a little figure. And what I have to do at this point is I have to choose some coordinate system. Although, again, in the end, I'm going to show that it doesn't depend on the coordinate system. And I draw a little loop in which I go around. Then I go up. So there's some x hat direction, some y hat direction, and some z hat direction. I start there. I go around the loop. I go up. I then take the commutator of that part, which is the Bayan operator. So I'm going to call this thing just gamma x hat y hat. And I'm going to call this thing gamma z hat with some abusive notation. And then the operator that I want, and now I have to make a decision about operator ordering. Because the F operator doesn't commute with the volume operator, which is in here in the commutator. So some timid souls put the F over on the right, on the left side. So I'm going to do that today. I don't always do that. So the operator that we want is U in the X hat, Y hat direction, X hat, Y hat direction, it's a presence of notation, minus 1. Then go in the u z hat direction up here. Then take the commutator of going back in the inverse of the u z hat direction with the volume operator of space. Then divide by 1 over the area squared, 1 over epsilon. And that whole thing, where I've run out of room. That whole thing this is the FAB. That whole thing is the Hamiltonian constraint operator regularized to loops of size alpha and of little length of size epsilon here. And then we want to integrate that over space, and we want to sum that over pairs x hat, triples x hat, y hat, z hat of directions. Okay, and that's the structure of the operator. Okay, and this is the basic structure of the operator that Thomas Tiemann constructed. So let me tell you what happens what this guy does. Because the amazing thing, and there's a lot of detail to go through that I'm not going to do, is that when properly defined, you get finite answers for this thing, and they're independent of the choices made in the direction, in all the regularization. You get a finite answer in the limit that alpha and epsilon go to zero, and it doesn't depend on how you chose the axes or anything. What happens is the following. This operator looks for nodes. Why does it look for nodes? Because there's a volume operator. If there aren't any nodes, then you're just going to get zero. Now, there's another edge here. So it's good enough to have a trivalent node, because you get another edge from here. Then you add this U, which is a little loop. So basically, what this operator does is it discovers nodes, at least trivalent nodes, and it discovers the tangent vectors coming out.
Isn't the trivalent not zero volume?
No, because there's a term on the other side of this commutator where the U creates an edge, and then you could have a four-valent node, and then the volume operator acts. And then the volume operator knows enough to add a loop which agrees with the tangent vectors of any two of the three or more edges coming from the node. And so what you get is that it takes a node and it adds an edge. So a node becomes three nodes with a new edge going across. And that's the basic action of the operator. Now, there's a very cool thing which I don't have time to explain. There's a certain amount of subtlety involved. But when you might worry that you're going to get terms that blow up because of 1 over epsilon with epsilon going to 0 and 1 over alpha squared and alpha going to 0. Okay. But you don't. You get from all the regularization terms proportional to, so alpha squared epsilon is roughly speaking the volume that the operator is exploring. Because it's going up, that z-axis was perpendicular to those two axes. And so you're getting a sort of volume element that's explored. And if the operator is within that volume, given by alpha squared epsilon, of the node, you pick up a term. So this gets canceled in the leading term. So you end up with something finite. Not only do you end up with something finite, you end up with something that when you take it down to diffeomorphism classes of states, all that happens as you further take the limit of alpha go to zero is that this curve here moves in because the alpha is shrinking. But on diffeomorphism classes, it doesn't change anything. The diffeomorphism class is that a new curve was added. And all that matters is that there are two nodes distinct of this node and a curve. The diffeomorphism class doesn't care, quote, how far it is between the nodes. So when you go down to diffeomorphism classes, the limit just becomes the identity. And the limit can be honestly taken, and it acts on these diffeomorphism classes and creates new diffeomorphism classes with two new nodes and an edge between them. Now, there's a lot of technicality to get to there and to prove. What you have to do is to define the operator on the space of all the states as a finite, well-defined operator for every value of alpha and epsilon, then take it down to diffeomorphism classes and show that on the diffeomorphism classes, which are a subspace of states, the limit is trivial, because there's no dependence explicitly on alpha and epsilon, and the limit doesn't, and as you bring the guys closer together, it doesn't change the diffeomorphism class. So in the end, you have an operator that acts on diffeomorphism classes in a way which is totally combinatorial, which is to take a node to three nodes and add an edge. So that's what the operator does.
What happens with the other ordering if you can I shut the
tell you the truth, I don't remember. There may or may not be some nasty terms. The nasty terms would come from the V acting on this U here.
So the reason we keep it in this form is because it's easier to handle.
Yes, but I don't remember in Thomas's version of the regularization how bad it is if you keep the other operator ordering. So that if it's somebody may know, but I don't know. There are different orderings which are used in different calculations for different purposes, and it's an open issue. What is the quote correct ordering? I mean, I think I know the right answer, but it's never been implemented. The correct ordering should be the ordering such that it appears in the proof of a positive energy theorem, such that it's part of the Hamiltonian which is proven positive. And we have some partial results with our chemistry about stuff about that, but we're not done. And I hope it's clear by now the flavor of these things, of all these calculations, is that either they work all the way through, that is, either all the factors coming from regularization is canceled, you get really a finite operator, it's unambiguous, you can extract it. Or you don't, or you get an infinite mess, infinite in both senses.
Is there any other operator which takes three nodes and creates one?
Well, once you have it, since it's actually defined on the Hilbert space, you can define it, actually.
So
you can go back. Once you have the operator, it's an operator in the well-defined Hilbert space, and its adjoint exists. And you can argue, and Thomas Tien and other people do, that I never did the whole job of putting the eyes back and worrying about the complex connection. There's stuff that, and I'm going to stop because I don't want to go until 11 o'clock at night. There's stuff about that that I probably should make a list of things to be sure to explain. But there is a form of the Hamiltonian constraint which is actually real, which is this plus another term, and that's real for Lorentzian signature. And that other term is a little bit more complicated, but has been handled by the same methods. And since the operator is, since the classical quantity is real, once you choose an ordering such that the quantum operator is permission, and there is an argument that the right way to do that is to take this operator plus its permission adjoint. And that, so that your sum becomes the operator, so that if you like, it raises and it lowers. What doesn't come from this kind of regularization that anybody has been able to show is an operator that does this. But that's a big issue. And I'll leave it at that. Any more questions?
Okay. So, how full is the one of the E that I'm using?
How, please?
So how full is the one of the E that we use?
How harmful is it?
It doesn't generate diffeomorphism.
No. This is an E, which is the determinant of E, which is one of the variables of the theory. So this is a well-defined object classically. It is a density of weight one classically. Therefore, you can integrate it over any region, and it's a sensible diffeomorphism-invariant object over that region. So it's not harmful. It's a good thing to do. Then, No, because, you see, if I had to here just write 1 over the square root of e, if I had to insert that complicated ugly thing, there would be no guarantee that that could be made into an operator. And 1 over the square root of the product of things is really, nobody knows if that can directly be related to an operator. The amazing thing is that the e lower here, the one-form basis elements, can be made into operators through this procedure. And so that's why this is a remarkable result, because this is the density weight that you want, so you can integrate it over any region and have a well-defined diffeomorphism invariant object. And with that density weight, it's exactly the right density weight to turn it into a finite operator when you realize that the E lower can play into an operator through this procedure. So it's remarkable. I mean, it was very unexpected when Thomas came out with this result, because the rest of us were playing with the operator in this form, and we had some partial results, and then we knew how to extract the diffeomorphism of brain states and so forth. But it wasn't terribly clean, and it suffered from the whole issue that it was the wrong density weight, so it wasn't the diffeomorphism invariant object when you integrated against space.
But it was looking at the H that has some physical interpretations.
This has the same physical interpretations divided by the determinant of the square root determinant of the metric. So that's fine. Any other questions?
The length
operator. What about the length operator? There is a length operator, and it's been almost never used. Roughly speaking, it was also the only person who took it seriously and worked it out was Thomas as well. So the length object is integral ds. QAB, gamma dot A, gamma dot B, that's the nature of the length operator. So it depends on, this is related to E lower. So basically the idea is that you define this as an operator. Now you can define Q with the metric with lower indices, because you can define the E with lower indices. So you have to do this twice. Then you have to take the square root. Then you have to integrate along the path. And you get something which is zero unless the paths intersect nodes of the spin network, in which case you get something that basically counts the nodes with some combinatorial factors. So Thomas has a series of papers called Quantum Spin Dynamics, number 1 to infinity. Well, not quite infinity, but maybe 14 or something like that. Okay. And one of those papers is, and the really scary thing is that they were all released on the same day. There was like nothing. And then all of a sudden there were all these papers, which is a very bad habit he does. That's drives. Anyway. So one of the papers in this, the first one is an overview, the second one does this operator, and then there's a whole bunch of other things that were in the series of papers, and one of them is the length operator. Okay, I'm going to stop.